You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper.
And I'm Doyle.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we've got a lot of information to impart to you. And you've got to be listening. You should have pen and paper to take notes with. And so that you can run around and get ready, here is something to do it by. Remember, you need pen and paper. You need to listen very carefully tonight. Especially if you have assets in paper, in the stock exchange, in bonds, in treasury, T-notes, any kind of paper investment whatsoever, you had better be listening tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, listen very, very carefully to me tonight. They said, the Asian markets wouldn't crash. They crashed. They said the crises wouldn't spread. It spread. They said the catastrophe would not affect us. You had better get ready. Tonight's broadcast is from an article that ran in Esquire magazine, volume 130, number 4, October 1998. Buy it. Keep it. Refer to it. Read it. Was written by Walter Russell Mead. Rule one is don't panic. Rule two is panic first. Not long ago, at a very private briefing about the state of the United States economy, attended by senior government officials from as far back as the Kennedy years and business and community leaders from all walks of life, a powerful figure in the room stood up. Sometimes, he said, it feels like 1928. Well, ladies and gentlemen, 1928 was, of course, the last good year before the crash of 1929. The entire room was stunned. But perhaps most frightening was that not a single one of the assembled wise men and women who attended that meeting raised a voice to contradict that gloomy assessment. The global economic crises of 1997 and 1998 is indeed a historic event. If there were an economics channel, as there is a weather channel, frenetic newscasters would be interrupting regular programming right now, this very second, to give us hourly updates on something they would be calling the storm of the century, an economic cataclysm as big as or bigger than the Great Depression of the 30s. And most Americans aren't even aware that anything is going on. The behavior of economic storms is as hard to predict as the course of a hurricane. Still, this storm already has a track record. And ladies and gentlemen, it's pretty damned chilling. If, God forbid, it reaches the United States, and it will, just since July, the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, has dropped 1,900 points. So watch out. In a blow like this, stock prices could easily fall by two-thirds. That's 6,000 points on the Dow, and it could take stocks a decade or more to recover. That is, if they recover. Most investors could be destroyed. Mass liquidation of mutual funds in a panic could wipe out some funds entirely. The carnage among 11 growth funds and such high-flying sectors as internet and technology companies would be appalling. Ladies and gentlemen, in a real meltdown, the damage would not be limited to the financial markets. Housing prices would plummet, leaving millions of highly leveraged home and apartment owners sitting on mortgages that are worth far more than their homes. Millions of people would lose their jobs, and tens of millions more would watch their wages drop as employers frantically tried to cut back their payrolls. Many cities would face bankruptcy as their tax revenues collapsed. You see, all these things and more have already happened in many countries around the world. Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, South Korea, Japan, Vietnam, Russia, South Africa, stock markets in these countries have fallen by as much as 60% or more. Unemployment rates are exploding. Countless people face the losses of their businesses, jobs, and homes. In some of these countries, there are riots in the streets and revolution is threatened. The people face starvation. Short of a massive asteroid strike from outer space, no natural disaster could destroy this much wealth or plunge this many people into misery. And more than a year after the crises began, not one country where it has struck shows any signs, not even the slightest, signs of recovery. With Japan, the world's second largest economy, and Russia, its second largest nuclear power, firmly in its grip, the economic crises now sweeping the planet may be the most important event and the most dangerous since the Second World War. Now, this isn't just an economic meltdown in a few emerging markets, ladies and gentlemen. It's a full-fledged crisis of the international economic system, one that could plunge the entire world into a major depression. And it's more than that. It could challenge the strength of the international political system and test the leadership of the country that widely and imprudently builds itself as the only global superpower. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the only global superpower has recently made some very stupid mistakes. We put our confidence in two basic ideas that turned out to be wrong. The first is that rapid deregulation of the international financial system would promote growth without creating dangerous financial crises. The second idea is that the export-oriented development model pioneered by Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea would keep working forever. In fact, that economic strategy hit a wall 10 years ago, and Japan's economy hasn't grown since. Now the problems have spread to the rest of Asia, halting the tigers in their tracks. Under Presidents Bush and Clinton, the United States has been the leading advocate of deregulating the global economy and reducing the barriers to investment and trade. The United States was quick to take credit when the system was working. Now that it could be melting down, the United States is sure to be stuck with the blame. And all across Russia and Asia, hundreds of millions of people are blaming their economic woes on devious American or Jewish plots. And having watched this situation develop, ladies and gentlemen, I've got to admit my feelings are mixed. I'm frightened by what may lie ahead. Heartsick over the suffering of tens of millions of people who have already been forced back into poverty and possibly starvation by this economic crisis. And hopeful that the various International Monetary Fund plans and Japanese economic initiatives will solve the problem before the world economy goes down the tubes. But there's another part of me that is awestruck. I am astonished that what we thought was so substantial has turned out to be so flimsy. I feel a little like a meteorologist in hurricane season, watching with fascination and dread as a nightmare assembles itself. And it all began as a small cloud, no bigger than a man's hand, quietly, the economic equivalent of a butterfly's wings in Beijing. There was a spot of trouble about the Thai baht, in itself one of the world's more insignificant currencies. Pooh-pooh, said the experts as the rumors swirled. Thailand's a tiger. High savings rate, rapid economic growth, strong property market, strong banking sector. No problem, said the World Bank. Asia's cool, and Thailand's cool. The currency speculators thought differently. The baht had been linked to the dollar for more than a decade. Now that link looked weak. At 24 baht to the dollar, Thai exports looked expensive compared with products from places like China and Indonesia. Why not, a few speculators thought, bet against the baht for a while and see what happens? What happened next, ladies and gentlemen, was spectacular. The Thai Central Bank spent billions of dollars in a hopeless effort to defend its currency. By July of last year, the baht had fallen below 32 to the dollar, and it was taking the Thai economy down with it. I visited Bangkok soon after the baht crash, and parts of the city already looked like a ghost town. Work had stopped on dozens of skyscrapers. Cranes were beginning to rust, and plastic sheeting was blowing off the sides of half-finished buildings. I checked out one of Bangkok's newest and most exclusive shopping malls, filled with Gucci and Versace vendors for the new generation of Thai yuppies. A piano player in a booth over the escalators put out bad late Elvis music as I cruised around the place. It looked like the sale of the century. Signs everywhere advertised 70% discounts. But nobody except me and the piano player was there to look at them. The mall was empty. The economists and the Asia experts were quick to reassure the world that the problem was limited to Thailand. Then a few rumors began to circulate about Malaysia. Ridiculous, the experts chorused together. Malaysia's economy wasn't weak like Thailand's, the experts pointed out. Malaysia wasn't corrupt. And the people were better educated. They were still giving speeches about how Malaysia would never go down. When crash. The Malaysian ringgit joined the Thai baht on the ash heap of history. I'm not talking about 1929, ladies and gentlemen. I'm talking about 1978. Malaysia's prime minister knew exactly what to do. He blamed the Jews. They were jealous, it seems, of predominantly Muslim Malaysia's success. And the next round of rumors concerned Indonesia. Once again, the pundits, diplomats, and business leaders rallied as one. Too bad about the ringgit, said the experts, and sorry we were wrong about the baht. But now we understand Malaysia had an erratic, some would say megalomaniacal, prime minister. Too many expensive prestige projects. Too many government interference with the credit system. And of course, Thailand was more crooked than a Little Rock law firm. But Indonesia wasn't like that. Yes, there was corruption and injustice, but at least the Indonesian government, competent, thoughtful, focused on the economic fundamentals, got the macroeconomic policy right. Indonesia was no Thailand, or Malaysia, they said. Let the baht and the ringgit sink to new lows. The rupiah was a stable currency, supported by a sound economy. Then, of course, the rupiah crashed, going from about 21,500 to the dollar when I visited in August 1997 to as low as 16,000 in January. Crash! Bang! Thump! And just like that, the rupiah took the Indonesian government down with it. This time, the blame was on the Chinese rather than the Jews, and panicky mobs rioted through the streets of Indonesian cities, burning, looting, and raping. The Chinese minority, 3% of the population, 3% of the population, controlling an estimated 70% of the economy, quickly moved to get as much money as possible out of the country, weakening the rupiah even further, and making economic recovery virtually impossible. And then, after Indonesia, the line changed. The line changed. listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper, according to William Jefferson Clinton, the most dangerous radio host in America. And now, you know why. The American people, ladies and gentlemen, are not supposed to know what you're hearing tonight. Southeast Asia, the experts suddenly discovered, had never really been much of an economic success. Those years when the World Bank, the IMF, that's the International Monetary Fund, and the economics profession joined hands to sing hymns of praise to Southeast Asian governments and their solid economic policies, were forgotten immediately. Southeast Asia, we now discovered, was full of paper tigers, water buffaloes with racing stripes, bad governments, uneducated people, unsophisticated technological bases, poorly functioning financial markets. The crisis was therefore contained, and there was no danger that it could spread from such tiny, badly managed economies to bigger, more important, and better managed ones up north. Like, for example, South Korea, thank God. Crash! Went the Korean won. I was there in January of this year. The won was in the toilet. The International Monetary Fund was in charge of the economy. The demonstrators were in the streets. And I saw signs in Seoul store windows advertising something called an IMF sale. Again, 70% off. But again, there were no buyers. Singapore, they then reassured us, was well managed. Crash, said the Singapore dollar. Hong Kong was much more dynamic than all those state-planned economics, they said. Guess what? Crash! Went the Hong Kong dong. And if you think that's humorous, it's really called the dong. I still have some, in fact, from my old Navy days. Hong Kong's stock market crashed. Japan's been a little sluggish, but it is fundamentally sound, of course, the experts. Japan's got the largest reserves in the world. Guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Crash, answered the yen. It was Lyndon Johnson's old nightmare. One Asian domino toppling after another, only it wasn't communists pushing the dominoes over, but investors. As the dominoes went down, the crisis shifted to the send in the clowns phase. Teams of International Monetary Fund experts rushed into the capital cities to confer with political and business leaders. They then emerged for photo ops, brandishing what they said were recovery plans and multi-billion dollar bailouts. Sometimes within weeks, but certainly within months, they came crawling back. So sorry. The first bailout plan wasn't big enough, and the recovery plan isn't working. A few billion more, a few more tweaks to the plan, and then another photo op followed in due course by new revelations that the bailout and the plan hadn't quite taken hold yet. The most significant thing that the world's leaders didn't understand is that the fabled Asian model of development wasn't all it was cracked up to be. When you are the first export-oriented economy in the world, you are competing with high-cost, inefficient Western producers. Your cheap workers and low taxes allow you to make goods at much less cost than the Germans and the Americans do. Therefore, you can slightly underprice the competition and make tons of money. But as more countries jump on the wagon slows under all the weight. The East Asian countries began to compete, not so much with the Germans and the Americans, as with each other. The ultimate result? Regional recession. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a development of historic importance. It means that Asia hasn't found the silver bullet to kill underdevelopment in a single generation, as everybody thought. The total cost of the crises is impossible to estimate. But looking at the stock market values and estimating the fall in property prices, the lost output, and the diminished purchasing power, total losses so far in Asia alone, just in Asia, not counting anywhere else where this has spread to, look like something on the order of over $2 trillion and going up all the time. Every day, as a matter of fact. But worse still, ladies and gentlemen, that was just Asia. You see, the crisis has spread beyond Asia. Russia stands on the brink of a total economic abyss. Not collapse, abyss. You talk about the bottomless pit, Russia is teetering on the brink of a hole with no bottom. Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, and even Chile look ill, and a currency collapse in South Africa threatens to undermine the fragile democracy and hopes for prosperity throughout the region. And of course, when I say democracy, of course it means socialism. Meanwhile, ladies and gentlemen, absolutely nobody is running this show. The people who should be in charge, the International Monetary Fund, the United States Treasury, the World Bank, have been wrong, 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 wrong. Everything that they have done has only exacerbated the problem. They did not see the crises coming. Once it started to develop, they were wrong about how far it would spread. As it spread, they were wrong about how bad it would be, and their efforts to fix the problem, by far the largest and most expensive financial bailout in world history, have so far been miserable failures. And who do you think is paying for it? To date, the International Monetary Fund alone has pumped tens of billions into the crises and has exactly nothing, nothing to show for it. Throw in the World Bank, throw in relief agencies and various other governments from around the world, and we are looking so far at a total of something like $140 billion of good money thrown after bad since July 1997. And clearly, the International Monetary Fund's program for Asia has not worked. If the economic crises were a wildfire, it would be out of control. The firefighters don't have the equipment or the manpower to contain it. Ladies and gentlemen, 1928 was a very good year. Thank you. as you listen to this broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, someone in the National Security Council is issuing orders to find out exactly how many Americans will hear this broadcast. There will be panic in the halls of government. Listening to the Hour of the Time, I'm William Cooper. Was a very good year. The American stock market, ladies and gentlemen, was setting one record after another. Millions of people who had never owned stocks were jumping into the market. Does that sound familiar? Does it? As economic growth without inflation plowed on year after year, economists demonstrated that technology-driven increases in productivity had brought the economy into a new era. Does that sound familiar? One in which the wicked old business cycle with its horrific busts and stock market crashes was a thing of the past. And again, I ask you, does that sound familiar? Prosperity wasn't limited to the United States. Most Americans don't realize that the 1929 crash was a worldwide depression. The international debt problem that had so vexed the earlier years of the decade had been solved. German inflation was over, and as prosperity swept through Europe, the ominous figure of Adolf Hitler had faded into the background. Democracy was putting down roots in Germany, and the emerging markets of Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia were modernizing their economies and political systems. With the creation of little Entente, the Western security system was pushed eastward to roughly the boundaries envisioned this year with the expansion of NATO. The Baltic republics, freed from their long domination by Russia, were looking westward. Does that sound familiar? Even perpetually unhappy Russia was looking better than usual. The privations and terroristic dictatorship of the Civil War era had settled down. And following Lenin's death, a new leadership had extended the new economic policy, allowing the return of independent business and foreign investment to Russia. There was a political and cultural thaw as well. It seemed to many people that Russia was abandoning its revolutionary dreams and was on its way back into the family of nations. Does that sound familiar? Throughout the world, the same happy combination of increased prosperity and increased democracy seems to be leading to an era of peace and economic integration. Foreign investment in China was bringing new technology and new hope to that ancient land. Japanese foreign policy was linked firmly to the Western allies. The United States, Britain, and Japan were working together to maintain peace and stability in the Pacific. In Latin America, economic reform had strengthened democratic governments in many countries. Mexico's long era of revolutionary turbulence was over. democratic governments in Argentina and Brazil. We're bringing those nations into the heart of the global economy. The international arms race was over. American diplomacy had led the way to radical international naval disarmament. The new world court promised to impose justice on aggressors, whatever that means, and give nations an alternative to war. In August 1, 1928, diplomats from all over the world assembled in Paris to sign the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which outlawed war forever. Can you imagine that? They really expected everyone to obey the law. 5 years later, it was all over. As the United States staggered through the worst depression in its history, the world economy went down the toilet, taking the world's political system with it. Stalin was firmly in power in Russia. Hitler had taken over Germany. In Japan, the militarists had emerged from obscurity to drive the peace-loving liberals from power. Dictatorships reigned across Eastern Europe and in Latin America as the world headed inexorably toward the most terrible war in its history. The Great Depression was simply the longest and worst in a long succession of economic panics and crashes that goes back as far as the current market system does, as the current philosophy of economics has reigned. The Dutch tulip craze, the Mississippi bubble in France, the South Sea bubble in Britain, the panics of 1837, 1857, 1873, 1890, 1907. Crises like these were recognized as normal, recurring aspects of the business cycle. You put up your monies, you take your chances. But the Great Depression was too much. Every bank in the United States was forced to close in 1933 for exactly 3 days. One out of every four workers lost his job. Millions of people lost every penny they had saved through lifetimes of hard work. And on top of all that, ladies and gentlemen, World War II. After the war, it was necessary to rebuild the international financial system from scratch. And the architects of the system believed that the price of regulation, slower growth, economic inefficiency was worth paying. Anything to prevent another depression and to reduce the risk of new wars. The world economy, American officials and international bankers decided, should act more like a school bus and less like a sports car, and they developed a comprehensive regime of regulations designed to keep the global economy moving smoothly, if not always, rapidly ahead. But as the memory of the Depression gradually faded, and as some of the controls developed after World War II became increasingly cumbersome, a shift in economic opinion occurred. Business leaders, economists, and politicians started to worry less about how safe the car was and began to focus once again on making it go faster. A largely unregulated international financial market was reborn in the late 60s, and gradually the entire system of capital controls, fixed currency rates, and other international regulations faded away and eventually disappeared from memory. This process was driven less by economic philosophy than by greed, greed, greed. That's why this concept of a utopian world will never work. After all, it will be humans once again running it. And the concept that imperfect man knows what's best for imperfect man is absolutely ludicrous upon its face. Private firms thought they could chase profits more efficiently if they weren't hampered by regulations and controls. Amazingly, as the regulations came off, we began once again to experience the kind of turmoil in capital markets that had been common before the 30s. The third world debt crises of the early 80s, the United States savings and loan crises in the middle of the decade, the collapse of the Japanese bubble economy in 1990, the Mexican peso crises of 1994, the bankruptcy of England's Barings Bank in 1995, and of course the collapse of BCI, and now the Asian meltdown are all examples of the kind of financial market crash that was once common. While United States stocks have mostly gone up, the 500-point Dow crashes of 1987 and 1997 and the 300-point drop of early August show that our stocks, too, have become more volatile with the deregulation of financial markets. Since July of this year, during its worst fall-off, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 1,900 points just since July. And don't be fooled by this little boost here that you all think is an indication that the market is going to go back up. That's your greed taking hold again. It's not going to happen. The faster capitalism goes, ladies and gentlemen, the more dangerous it gets. Yet ever since the end of the Cold War, the United States has acted as if its agenda, peace and prosperity at home and abroad, were something simple and easy to create. What arrogance! Demolish a few trade barriers here. Open up a few stock markets to foreign investments there. Prune back some budget deficits and throw in a generous helping of deregulation. And, of course, never let anybody suffer because of their foolishness. Bail them out if they get in trouble. In other words, disable the brakes, grease the truck, jazz up the power supply, rip out the guardrails, and fire the safety inspector. And point the truck down a steep grade. For 25 years, the United States has been using its international influence to make the global economic system more and more like the laissez-faire free market system of the 20s, and now we've got what we wanted. A system that is free to grow rapidly and, surprise, surprise, free to crash and burn. But only for fools. Only for fools, ladies and gentlemen. Worse still, we have an economic and political leadership that knows nothing about the dynamite with which it so ignorantly plays. Even as the Asian economy blows up under its feet, our leadership has been slow to realize the full nature of the political risks that exist. There are several billion people in Asia. Some of them know a great deal about technologies that would be useful in war. And until a few months ago, most of them expected to keep getting rapidly richer. Now the overwhelming majority face huge economic losses. And for most of them, hope is quickly disappearing. And you know that anger will take its place. And it is all too likely that political leaders in Asia will seek to direct that anger outward at the United States and its economic allies, who, after all, shaped the international economic system that has produced this collapse. The United States brought this crisis about, a Thai journalist told me last summer, because it was afraid that Asia was growing too fast and would leave the United States behind. It does not, ladies and gentlemen, it does not, quite frankly, take a rocket scientist to predict that this will all end in tears, many, many tears, a flood of tears. Despite the horrors of the crises and the danger ahead, one can take a perverse pleasure in the discomfiture of the Western economic leadership. ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, or the supposed collapse of the Soviet Union, Western economists and politicians have been too smug for words. Communism was dead, they said. Even the mild forms of socialism practiced in Western Europe looked pretty sickly. And if that's true, why is it that we're rushing headlong into socialism? It's a deception, that's why. And this world economic collapse is designed to ensure the success of socialism and fulfill one of the major planks of the Communist Manifesto, which is the elimination of the middle class, the bourgeoisie, as they call it. The secret to growth, they said, was simple. Get out of the way. Get out of the way and growth will come. If government would just let business get on with business, economies would grow and markets would boom, they said. This wasn't just the secret to prosperity. It was the secret to history, too, they said. Prosperity leads to democracy, and democracy leads to peace. And what have I taught you about that? Democracy is a code word for socialism. And peace was defined by both Marx and Lenin as the absence of opposition to socialism. And all of this has been the mantra of the American government since the end of the Cold War. Both George Bush and Bill Clinton built their foreign policies around this simple and appealing set of ideas. Francis Fukuyama summed it up in his famous 1992 book, The End of History and the Last Man. History was over, said Fukuyama, and America had won. There won't be any more world-wrenching depressions, any more bitter struggles between great ideologies. The chief activity of the 21st century will be shopping, he said. And go back and get my old tapes and listen to what I told you. Listen to what I told you. I've always thought this was idiotic stuff, and I've been honestly terrified to see the American political elite betting the ranch on it. Somehow these people have gotten the idea in their heads that capitalism is safe, sane, and predictable. Even a quick look at history shows that that isn't true. Ever since capitalism began to form in early modern Europe, the Western world has seen one terrible convulsion after another. The French Revolution, the Reign of Terror, the Napoleonic Wars, 1848 and the rise of Marxism, the Civil War in the United States, the Commune in Paris, World War I, the collapse of the great European empires, the rise of communism and fascism, World War II, etc., 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 etc. But none of these things were caused by the world economic system. They were caused by what they are always caused by, greed and lust for power. And it wasn't a quiet ride. A capitalist world isn't a rest home for lazy politicians and boneheaded social scientists. Socialism won't cure it either. It's an exhilarating place where new technologies and new industries sprang up overnight. New ideas sweep across the world, and individuals have the chance to remake the world and ride the cutting edge of change. But only if they are responsible and are not greedy, and do not have great thirst for power, and do not band together to force their agendas down the throats of others. It's only a good ride under responsibility and freedom. And that's the key to every good ride, no matter what good ride it happens to be. You see, it can also be a place of great painful destruction. The old manufacturing economy in America had to die so that the new service economy could be born. That messed up millions of lives. 50-year laid-off steelworkers in Pittsburgh couldn't start life anew as website designers because somebody had taught them that their brain didn't work like anyone else. They thought that what they had been taught to do was the only thing they could ever do. Family farming as a way of life died out so that efficient agribusinesses and control over mass quantities of food could take its place. And the excuse was so they could feed our enormous population with cheap food. Banking deregulation led to the savings and loan crises. Downsizing restructured American corporations and trashed American lives, even as new management techniques enhanced profitability. These economic disruptions are really peas under a mattress compared with the Great Depression and the upheaval in Asia today. Just peas under a mattress, and only a princess can tell where it is. Everybody else sleeps soundly. But still, ladies and gentlemen, these events transformed American politics, bringing us Ronald Reagan and the destruction of the New Deal coalition. The economic crises of 1997 and 1998 will similarly reshape our future. And perhaps you would be interested in seeing some pictures of how the world could look as the crises moves on. So get a hold of yourself. Make sure that you're comfortable. Make sure there's someone standing nearby to catch you when you fall out of your chair. Also, you'd better put your doctor on standby before you hear this. To the hour of the time, I'm William Cooper. Tonight's broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, is actually a magazine review. It's taken from Esquire, Volume 130, Number 4, October 1998. Rush out and buy it. You must have a copy of this article for your own. You must be able to refer to it in order to help others understand what is happening. Esquire Magazine, Volume 130, Issue Number 4, October 1998. The article was written by Walter Russell Mead. And you must have the article anyway, because I am sprinkling this broadcast with my own comments, knowledge, and observations. And for all you ditto heads, if you listen to the Hour of the Time long enough, you will discover that Rush Limbaugh hasn't got a clue. Not even the slightest. Listening to WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA. Get ready, folks. Here it comes. The first picture I'm going to bring into your mind is called American Recession. The long period of American economic expansion, ladies and gentlemen, is most probably over. As Asians buy fewer United States goods and sell their own goods here for less and less, American companies will have a harder and harder time making money. This puts pressure on earnings. As late as this summer, the stock prices of American companies assumed double-digit earnings growth as far as the eye could see. As people lose faith in that earnings story, stock prices will continue to trend lower. And under certain circumstances, that downward trend could accelerate into a crash. And I'm telling you that it will. In fact, I call a fall of 1,900 points, 1,900 points on the Dow Jones Industrial Index, a crash. Gentlemen, a crash. The crash is in process, has been in process for a year. Remember, in May of 1997, I predicted that on October the 24th of 1997, the Dow Jones Industrial Average would fall over 500 points, and it did. I predicted that a worldwide economic crash was then in its beginning stages and would proceed through Asia and from there to the third world nations of the West and then to the major industrial and wealthiest powers of the world 1 year later. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this October 24th will be the end of that 1 year. And just since July, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has dropped 1,900 points. And oh yes, it seems to have recovered a few dollars within the last week, and that is normal. And then once the magnitude of what's happening around the world begins to catch up with the American economy, it will once again plunge. And it will continue to plunge, and there will be slight periods of recovery, and then it will plunge again. It's not going to fall into the pit right away. In fact, the Asian crises could give the old bull one more run if Japanese capital flees that country's troubled banks and stock markets to seek refuge in the United States. But there's another scenario. The Japanese could sell all of their paper in this country in order to save their economy. And my bet lies with that scenario because I know the Japanese people. In the meantime, we are presently well into the greater fool era of the bull market. That is, everybody knows that most stocks today are simply not worth the high prices they are fetching, but people continue to buy them. That's the fool factor, the sheeple factor. And not because they think that corporate earnings will reach the astronomical levels necessary to justify these stellar stock prices, but because you can always count on a bigger fool than you appearing in the market who will be willing to pay even more for those overvalued stocks than you just did. In fact, buy high, sell low could be the Japanese national motto. And Japanese investors are perhaps the only people in the world today who would be willing to bring massive amounts of new capital into America's stock market. They're also about the only people in the world today who would be willing to sell all of their holdings in the American stock market. And when either one of those happens, watch out. Once the greatest fool of all has taken over the market, it's time to get out. Mass Japanese movement toward or out of the United States market could be the trigger that first pushes the Dow up to genuinely insane levels and then causes a long overdue and long-term crash, which will happen. There's one other ugly problem facing our economy. It's called the dollar. Are to be absolutely legally correct, a Federal Reserve note, because a piece of paper can no more be a dollar than a quart can be milk. A dollar is just a measurement of a certain weight and purity of gold or silver coin. With our world record trade deficits, the United States has become a debtor nation that needs to import foreign capital every year just to balance its books. If the American stock market falls and investors lose faith that it will rise again quickly, many European investors are likely to take their money home. And while the United States is nearing the end of a long expansion, Europe's economy is just starting up. Growth seems to be accelerating in Germany, and countries like France, Italy, and Spain are also reporting good economic news. But reporting it does not make it true, ladies and gentlemen. If you'll notice, their markets have also been having problems. Furthermore, there's probably more long-term potential in European stocks now than in United States stocks. And for 20 years, American companies have been growing leaner and meaner as management worked to unlock value and return it to shareholders. European companies are, generally speaking, at a much earlier stage in this process. If financial markets turn sour in the United States, look for the rats, pardon me. Our trusty NATO allies to desert the sinking ship. A European flight from our stock market will accelerate the market's decline. This would also lead to a dollar crisis like the yen, the ringgit, the rupiah, and the baht. The dollar could sink to new lows as foreign capital flees the United States. And just recently, just 2 weeks ago, ladies and gentlemen, both the dollar and United States bonds, United States Treasury bonds, dropped against the yen. If our currency collapses in the midst of the crises, look for a global depression on the scale of the one in the 1930s, and a major war is more than likely to follow. But enough about us. The real worries are elsewhere, in, for example, China and Russia, two nuclear powers that had their doubts about the world system even before the global economic crises threatened to crush them both. And what about the Y2K problem? You see, that's not really the issue. It's the reaction of the sheeple to a perceived problem that will cause complete chaos and disaster. And then, the next picture, China. Picture this, ladies and gentlemen. Few Americans understand just how explosive the situation in China is. As the country undergoes the biggest economic revolution in world history, it is also in for the wildest ride in world history on the roller coaster of revolution capitalism. Or I should say, actually, revolutionary capitalism. State-owned rust bucket industries from Maoist times are slowly collapsing, putting heavy demands on the national treasury. Yet China's banks, which may have the worst balance sheets in the world, would go bankrupt if the state cut off subsidies to the indebted state industries. And if these industries lay off workers faster than the private economy can find them jobs, China faces mass unrest in the big cities. This is what the Chinese government fears most. And ladies and gentlemen, it has good reason. Already, millions of Chinese uprooted from the rural areas where they were born are flooding into the coastal cities looking for work. Many of them are young men, the most volatile group in any society. And in China today, they are especially volatile. Thanks to the government's one-child policy, many Chinese families have aborted female fetuses to ensure that their one child is a boy. And this preference has led to no boys being born for every 100 girls. Actually, that's backwards, ladies and gentlemen. This preference has led to no girls being born for every 100 boys. Now, here's a Chinese nightmare. Millions of young, poorly educated men who have no jobs, and no girlfriends in a country where they have been taught that revolution is good. It's almost unthinkable that China can escape a prolonged Asian slowdown. China has also based its whole plan on exported growth working far into the future. With the failure of that strategy, China's economy must slow dramatically. To survive, the Chinese government will have to play the nationalist card, taking a tougher foreign policy line on issues like Taiwan and whipping up public support by talking about foreign, read American, threats to China. Alternatively, China could fall apart as it did earlier in the 20th century, going through a period of civil war and anarchy in a country with nuclear weapons before a new and probably very unpleasant government establishes control. Or maybe it could split up into several unpleasant governments. And if that isn't bad enough, here's another picture. I call it the biggest bear in the woods. The current round of global economic trouble couldn't have come at a worse time for Russia. After years of painful struggle and restructuring, it was beginning to look last year as if Russia's economy might actually begin to grow. That was after a decline approaching 50% since the supposed end of communism. Since the end of the Cold War, Western policy toward Russia has been a textbook case in how to drive a people to fascism. Almost everything we have done to Russia repeats what the foolish Western allies did to Germany after World War I. That, plus the Depression, put Hitler in power. And unless something radically changes, or unless we are much luckier than we deserve to be, I'm telling you right now, communism will return to Russia. I told you that a long time ago. The Cold War ended without a military defeat of the Red Army. The same thing happened to Germany in World War I. The United States told the Russians that we had nothing against the Russian people. It was only the Soviet system that we detested. And this is exactly what Woodrow Wilson said to the Germans in 1918. Sounds familiar, once again. Furthermore, Wilson, in the 14 points, promised a just peace to the Germans. And lo and behold, that is exactly what we did in the Cold War, and we also said that the transition to a market economy would make the Russians better off. You ought to hear what they have to say about that. Lies, 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 lies. It turned out both times. Both the Cold War and World War I ended with punitive peace agreements. Germany lost land to Poland, and millions of Germans suddenly became ethnic minorities in badly run countries where they were second-class citizens. The same thing happened to the Russians. Russia's current borders are obviously absurd and unjust. Tens of millions of Russians in such babushka republics as Ukraine and the various Central Asian ikistans are second-class citizens, despised and mistrusted by their incompetent new rulers. Add economic trouble. In both Germany and Russia, hyperinflation wiped out the savings of the middle class. Living standards dropped, criminals prospered, and honest people starved. Sound familiar? That's exactly what's happening in Russia today. Finally, after 1918, the Allies continued to discriminate against Germany. The same thing, ladies and gentlemen, is happening today. Russia is being shut out of both NATO and the European Union and is still treated as an enemy. Even with all these disadvantages, democracy, again that code word for socialism, almost won in Germany. Late in the 20s, the German economy began to revive. The communists and Nazis lost support. It looked as if democracy might put down roots after all. Then came the Depression. And in that case, ladies and gentlemen, democracy meant communism. There were only two groups vying for power in Germany at that time, communism and socialism. Then came the Depression, and millions of Germans were thrown back into poverty. Under those conditions, the majority of voters in Germany soon opted for anti-democratic parties, meaning anti-communism, and by the end, the Nazis and the communists between them accounted for almost two-thirds of the vote. And in the end, Hitler's Nazi party won. The National Socialist German Workers' Party won. Socialism won out over communism. Democracy and weak government in Russia have brought only national humiliation and personal economic privation for millions of Russians. Russia today is a land awaiting a master, a savior, a messiah, if you will. And here's the millennium looming ahead of us, promising such a Messiah. Russia, ladies and gentlemen, today looks ominously like Weimar Germany. At mid-century, Americans were sobered and seasoned by the terrible threats they had grown up with. The Depression, followed by the Second World War, followed by Stalin's quest to extend his totalitarian system throughout Europe. They looked back on the 1920s with bitterness as a time when a careless and superficial generation neglected its responsibilities and squandered the opportunity to build a real peace. Now, this will likely be the way that future Americans look back at the 90s. We ignored the lessons of history, danced on the boneyard of the 20th century, and acted as if we were invulnerable, as if history could never touch us. But ladies and gentlemen, history is not over. And unfortunately, we are going to discover that fact. History is back. And ladies and gentlemen, it's hungry. It's famished. It's looking for a meal. And the meal is us. Tonight's broadcast was taken from an article which appeared in Esquire, Volume 130, Issue Number 4, October 1998. It was written by Walter Russell Mead. Sprinkled throughout this article are my own comments, the results of my own research and observations. I want you all to go out and get Esquire magazine, Volume Number 130, Issue Number 4, October 1998. You need to read this. You need to study it. You need to show it to your neighbors. You need to understand what's coming. And you're so used to just hearing it from me, you need to hear it from someone else who knows what he's talking about. To the Hour of the Time, I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, that ought to make you stay awake until the wee hours of the morning, if you care. And just should you believe that that this is not hurting us. I'm going to read you this again. I read you this as of October 1st, I believe, was when I did this. As of October 1st, the American exchange was off 26%. 26% of the value of that market disappeared into thin air. The NASDAQ down 34% of its value. Disappeared into thin air. Standard & Poor's 100 down 22%. Standard & Poor's 500 down 23%. The New York Stock Exchange down 23%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 21%. And that's before it hit the 1900 point low between then and now. The market has gone up slightly just in the last week. Don't be fooled by that. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I've done my part for tonight's broadcast. Here's Doyle. Where are you? Where'd he go? Anybody seen Doyle?
Over here.
Oh, you're taking 101 off the air. Okay, 101.1 going off the air while Doyle does the rest of the broadcast. It will be back on, I don't know, maybe before the end of the broadcast if he wants to take calls, and maybe not. But if you're listening to 101.1 in the Round Valley of Arizona, tune in about every 15 minutes until you catch us back on the air. If you want to catch us right at the time we come back on, then make sure you do it about every 4 or 5 minutes. At this time, 101.1 FM will leave the air until Doyle finishes with his commercial announcements and whatever else he wants to do. The rest of the broadcast belongs to him. And once again, let me try this again. It's Doyle.
Hello.
That's the end of it.
Okay. All righty. Sounds good.
I'm out of here.
All righty. Take it easy. All right. I think first off, I'd like to cover a couple quick general things, and then I want to go into some of the audio broadcasts that are available. First off, let's cover the address and phone number for information, inquiries, purchasing, whatever. The address is Hour of the Time, care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. And the phone number, if you'd like to call and leave a message for questions or inquire or whatever, the number is 520-333-4578. That is also the fax line if you wish to fax us. Okay, I'd like to cover first the audio tapes that are available and the prices. The prices for audio tapes are as follows. A 1 hour tape is $11. A 2 hour tape is $12. And a 3 hour tape or broadcast, however you want to refer to it as, is $13. So just remember for the broadcast length, which is available and the information packet, it's next day for every show. 1 hour is 11, 2 hours is 12, 3 hours is $13, postage paid for the audio programs. What I'd like to do is cover some of the shows just within the recent months that are, to me, highlights of a lot of the shows. All the shows are good, and you're guaranteed to learn something. Some of these shows really stuck in my mind. I'd like to discuss a few of those. In July, Federal Jurisdiction, Part 1 and Part 2. June and July. Federal Jurisdiction, Part 1 and Part 2 by William Cooper. Another one, American Crisis, Part 1 and Part 2. Excellent show. When I say Part 1 and Part 2, these sets go together to get the full content and gist of the programming. Again in July, Affidavit and Jurisdiction Challenge. It's a three-part set, broadcast over 3 nights. Affidavit and Jurisdiction Challenge, 1, 2, and 3. Another one, BATS Special Agent Littleton, Part 1 and Part 2, also in July. That's BATS Special Agent Littleton, Part 1 and Part 2. Those aired in July. These are just some of the highlights that really stick in my mind. Some more I'd like to cover. The Ominous Parallels. It was played the first week of August. It is a rerun from earlier. The Ominous Parallels, Part 1 and Part 2. An excellent set. Those two go together. One other set that has its own pricing. So please note this. The Illuminati Series, Part 1, Part 2, and Part 3. The set should be ordered together. A really good set. Illuminati, number 1, number 2, and number 3, that set is $33. That's the exception there. $33 for that three-part set. Illuminati, number 1, 2, and 3. Another one, Complex Trust by Bob Swan. Really good tape. If you're curious about what a trust is, how it can help you maintain your family heritage and your assets, Complex Trust by Bob Swan is an excellent show. Another set is Psychopolitics. It's a four-part set. It was aired over four nights. Psychopolitics, four one-hour tapes, number one, two, three, and four. That was in September. Another one, UN Supreme, says State Department. It was a broadcast from prior. It was a rerun in September. UN Supreme, says the State Department. Excellent one-hour show. Some more I'd like to cover right here. These different programs here, all are along the same thought line. Ron Howe, Apollo Moonshots, one-hour broadcast. Moongate, 1/6 Gravity, that's another one-hour broadcast. The Mysteries of Gravity, Part 1 and Part 2, that set really belongs together if you want to purchase that. The Mysteries of Gravity, Part 1, Part 2, excellent set. Going on in September, the WBCQ debut, 1 and 2. It's a two-tape set, 3 hours. The Declaration of Independence, a 3-hour set. It's a really good show. I've had a lot of good feedback on that one. If you want to hear about what the Founding Fathers did to establish this constitutional republic, what they went through, the signers, their turmoils and hardships for putting their lives on the line, this is an excellent set. And you get a much broader understanding, much more accurate understanding of the Constitution, Declaration of Independence. This is a really good set. Declaration of Independence, 3-hour show. Another one, Continuing War of the Worlds. A lot of people had fun with that one. Got a lot of feedback the next day in town from people here in the Round Valley that listen on 101.1 FM. That's the Continuing War of the Worlds. Another one that stands out is Clayton Douglas. The interview with Clayton Douglas, where he was here in the studio with us. It's a really good set. That's also a 3-hour broadcast. What are we going to do? That is a really good broadcast. That one really makes you think. What are we going to do? 3-hour broadcast. Concentration Camp. That was an overview of an article, a direct reading actually from an article from a Look magazine back in, I believe it was 1963. It's an excellent set. You see, I've dug it out here. Yes, Look from May 28, 1968, excuse me. America's Concentration Camps. 3-hour broadcast. It's a really good show also. Luciferian Philosophy in October. 3-hour broadcast. Luciferian Philosophy. 3-hour broadcast. Culminating years of research, quotes from various authors' books and research by William Cooper. That's the Luciferian Philosophy. The interview with Michael Cremo on Forbidden Archaeology. It discussed his background, what got him started doing his research, his book, the hardships he faced by exposing what he did, some of the artifacts. Talked about the first one, Forbidden Archaeology, and Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, the second book. That's a really good interview there also. Michael Cremo, Forbidden Archaeology. Now, all these tapes that I've just mentioned are available, and you can find out about these tapes through the information list. Okay? The information packet covers the books, the videos, the special full audio set of Mystery Babylon. Also has the 1998 broadcast, starting with January 5th, Chiapas in Montana, and going up to current. The price is, again, for a one-hour audio tape, the price is $11 postage paid. Two-hour tape, $12 postage paid. And for a three-hour show or broadcast, $13 postage paid. The three-hour show is two 90-minute tapes, just so you know. If you would like to order any of these audio tapes, you can write to Hour of the Time, care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925, or you may call 520-333-4578 if you need more information or would like to request an update. You can also, in writing, if you're requesting an information packet and you have an old tape list, you can request an update. One of the other special sets, besides the Illuminati set, really needs to go together. The Illuminati three-part set is $33, postage paid. Another really special set is Mystery Babylon. Mystery Babylon set is the exposure of the origins, history, doctrines, and identity of Mystery Babylon. It's a full series of audio tapes and a video from William Cooper's The Hour of the Time. The Mystery Babylon set is 41 audio tapes plus the Luxor videotape, which is Mystery Babylon number 33 in the series. 41 audio tapes plus a videotape. The price for that, Mystery Babylon, is $290 postage paid. It's a lot of information. Years of research went into this. Some of the topics covered, 68th Convocation of the Rose Cross Order, interviews with William Morgan, Jordan Maxwell, America's Assignment with Destiny, In the Coils of the Coming Conflict, United Nations Meditation Room, Secret Societies and Vatican II, Rose Cross College, Part 1, Part 2, and Part 3, Occult History of the Third Reich, three parts, From Babylon to Christianity. This is a very large set. Again, the Mystery Babylon set is 41 audio tapes, plus the Luxor videotape, which is number 33 in the series. The price is $290, postage paid. Okay. If you would like to get an overview, if you don't already have a tape list, again, just request the information packet. To get that, you need to send a number 10 self-addressed stamped envelope with 75 cents postage, and include $1 for reproduction of the pack, and you can get the information packet. And just be a quick note, I want the information packet. Put in a dollar, and a self-addressed stamped envelope with 75 cents postage. We'll know exactly what to get you. Okay, the packet has a biography of William Cooper on the front. It covers the books, the audio book, the videos, Veritas, the Mystery Babylon series, the treason documents, the 1998 tape list. It's all included. Order forms, list of additional products like the radios, the antenna kit, whatnot are in there. It's a really good thing. If you don't already have one and you're interested in any of this stuff, you really should just order the information packet. It's much easier than calling, requesting information about this item, that item, this item. This is a much more efficient way, and you can get the full scoop all at once. Okay, again, that's $1 with the number 10 self-addressed stamped envelope with 75 cents postage for the information pack. Next, I want to cover another audio set. This is the alternative audio two-tape set of Behold a Pale Horse. Fully professionally produced in a studio with a beautiful full-color packaging on the outside. It's a two-tape, three-hour set. It's an abridgment of the book, Behold a Pale Horse. This is the audio book. It's read by William Cooper with 10 minutes of new material. It's $19.95, postage paid. It's a really nice set. It's $19.95, postage paid, for the audio book of Behold a Pale Horse. Now, I want to cover methods of payment. If you wish to order something, you can send cash, blank money order, gold or silver coin. No checks will be accepted. They will be disposed of. They will not be cashed. Do not worry. We're not going to rip you off. Filled out money orders will be sent back to you. Okay, that's blank money orders, cash, gold or silver coins only for purchases. I want to cover Veritas. Veritas, the full-size international newspaper. It's hand-delivered to key representatives and media bureaus in Washington, D.C. fully documents its sources for readers to confirm. Veritas presents the facts. You make your own decision. We challenge our readers to think for themselves. It's a full-size newspaper. If you would like to get a sample copy of it, it'll be the current issue. A sample copy of Veritas is $5 postage paid. If you'd like to get a subscription to Veritas, it's $55 for 12 issues. You get 12-issue subscription for $55 for Veritas. It's a really good newspaper. And we're not talking about a newsletter or anything like that. It's a full-size newspaper, professionally laid out and written, documents its sources for the readers to check out. Okay. Again, a lot of people have had inquiries in letters or on the phone about the Veritas. Just go ahead and order a sample copy. You won't be disappointed. And a sample is $5. Subscription is $55 for 12 issues. That's postage paid for Veritas. Another really good one in the printed material is the treason documents. KIG offers absolute proof of treason against the United States of America and the 50 sovereign states. The United States Constitution is not in effect. The United States is not sovereign. The United States of America is a vassal state of the United Nations. The armed force of the U.S. is the police force for the New World Order under the United Nations. 628 pages of official U.S. government documents. It's a huge set of information. I think if you heard earlier this week, you'll recall the interview with Paul, where he went through doing his own research and found the documents and everything, the articles, the clippings, the laws, the statutes. Everything's in there, State Department documents. And he verified that you can go out and do the research. He's no different than any of the rest of us. Any of you can do that. The treason documents will give all this to you, and they really give you a lot of information. The price is $85, postage paid, for the treason documents. It's a lot of information. Be prepared to sit down and study if you order this. And you're going to refer to it time and time again. The book, Behold a Pale Horse, written by William Cooper. It's 500 pages. The most well-documented, most suppressed information ever published. It's an excellent, very large book, 500 pages, documented. Price is $30, postage paid for Behold a Pale Horse, written by William Cooper. This also is a very informative book, which you will refer to and go back and read passages from, whole chapters, the whole book, time and time again. Oklahoma City Day 1. It's a detailed account of the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, April 19, 1995. Written by Michelle Marie Moore with a foreword by William Cooper. The price of Oklahoma City Day 1 is $16 postage paid. The true facts of the bombing bear no resemblance to the official story. The truth is shocking. You must read Oklahoma City Day 1 or you will never really know what happened on April 19, 1995. Every piece of evidence is fully documented. Complete references are provided. You won't put this book down until you've finished it. And then you'll return to it time and time again. In this monumental work, you are taken on a journey which begins with the explosions and continues through the final dramatic rescue of the last survivor. The real story of the bombing is a mind-numbing account of federal deceptions, media manipulation, and witness intimidation. Deliberate suppression and manufacture of evidence, the cruel exploitation of survivors and their family members, attempts to destroy independent investigations, and the government's efforts to conceal the documentation that reveals a foreknowledge of the pending disaster by many federal, state, and local officials. This is a huge book. Over 600 pages, Oklahoma City Day 1, $16, postage paid. Okay, Again, if you are interested in any of these materials, the audio tapes. Now remember, when I gave you descriptions of some of the audio broadcast shows, those are just a few of the highlights that really stuck in my mind. It doesn't mean they're any better than any of the rest of them. But they're just ones that really stuck out to me. As I look down the list, all these shows are really good. Many of them new, many of them reruns of very special shows from the past. All this is available in the information packet. Again, you can call 520-333-4578. You can fax on that number. You can leave a voicemail message for anybody. It's got voicemail boxes, so you can direct it to whomever you would like to. Or you can write the hour of the time, care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, that's spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Okay. Once again, the prices of the audio tape broadcast are $11 for 1 hour, $12 for 2 hour broadcast, and $13 for a 3 hour broadcast. The 3 hour broadcast is two tapes, two 90-minute tapes. Okay, just so I can clarify that, I've had a few questions of recent on the phone, so I wanted to clarify that with everybody, especially if you have a older price list before before the 2 hour shows and 3 hour shows were a regular thing. These are the prices for the audio broadcast. Okay. I think now what I'd like to cover real quick is the antenna kit. The antenna kit that we have to offer is a shortwave wire antenna kit. It can be arranged in a long wire or a loop, a small loop. A dipole fashion, which can be inverted V, that's up to you. It's a complete kit with instructions. It's got the mathematical formulas to trim the wire to the exact length for a given frequency. Although I suggest you try the full length first, if that's feasible when you set it up. As far as how hard it's going to be or the space confinements and whatnot, if it's fairly easy to get back down, I would suggest you try the full length first before you start trimming it. If you're happy with the reception over a large range of broadcasts, then just leave it there. If not, trim it down in length and you can better tune it. The antenna kit comes with 70 foot of 7-strand high-grade copper, uninsulated wire, that's your antenna wire, has 50 foot of lead-in wire, two ceramic insulators, two end insulators, which is to suspend the wire on the ends, especially if you're making it in a long wire fashion. Comes with full instructions, has another component to aid in passing the antenna as far as the lead-in through a wall or through a window seal. And the instructions cover dipole arrangement, long wire both. And like I said, it has all the mathematical formulas. It's step-by-step, very easy to follow. It's illustrated with the dipole and long wire. The price of the antenna kit is $24.95. That's posters paid, priority mail. It's $24.95, posters paid for the long wire antenna kit. Okay, cover real quick two or three of the radios. First off, I'd like to start off with the ATS-404. It's one of their newest models from Sangene. It's an excellent radio. The ATS-404 is a good, high-quality radio in the mid-price range of portable radios. It's got many of the top high-quality components of higher-priced models on the market in a smaller package with a lower price. It's full performance. Digital, AM, FM, stereo, shortwave receiver, continuous coverage of all shortwave bands and any frequency in between. That's the bands of 120 meter down to 11 meter, in case you're curious. Auto memory scan, it automatically scans every memory preset and plays each one in sequence for 7 seconds. That's a nice feature if you have certain stations in general that you like to listen to, or they have really good signal for your geographic location. It's a nice feature. You can hit it, takes all your presets, scans through them, plays them in order, displaying the frequency and the meter band and the signal strength, plays them for 7 seconds apiece, and goes on to the next one. You can stop on any one of them. It's a good way to scan through and hear different topics real quick that might be being covered, or to hear a station for its signal strength. It's got an illuminated LCD display, a very large display, mind you. The frequency readout is very large. Goes out to the thousandths. Reads out megahertz and kilohertz both, FM, obviously. It's got 12 and 24 hour time display, second display, adjustable timer. It's keypad entry. That is a great aid in listening to a station or finding a station. If you know the frequency, like WBCQ, 7.415 megahertz, you just enter that. It's real simple. Free 7.415, it's got a decimal point on the pad. Boom, enter, and you're done. It's also got tuning up and down with arrows. It's really easy to use. 45 memory presets that allows you to enter in 45 stations in the memory, and then you can just type in a code to go right to them. Real simple thing, too. I don't mean like a social security number size code. I'm talking number 23. Or you can use the scan function. It's got a lock switch, which is nice. You can lock out the radio once entries have been made into the memories, and it prevents accidental tampering, which sometimes happens. Especially if it's, if you're programming stuff and you haven't locked it out, sometime on a preset or anything, it would be quite easy to change. It comes with a carrying case. Stereo earbuds are included. Those are the kind of earbuds you kind of place within the outer portion of the ear. They don't have the band that goes over your head. They're very comfortable to wear. Sangene, by the way, makes one of the best sets of earbuds on the market. They're very high quality, comparable to much more expensive ones by other large name people. The price of the ATS 404. Excuse me there. I'm a little dry. Price of the ATS 404 is $99.95 plus postage $6. That's the ATS 404, $99.95 plus $6 postage. Next thing I'd like to cover real quick. People have told me a few predicaments they've had with the shortwave, either traveling and whatnot, or if they're out, they like to take it with them if they go camping or whatnot, or go outside to listen, or their space confinements don't allow them to put up a large external antenna. Sangene has a portable shortwave antenna. It's a wire one. It's called the ANT60. It's a really nice little package. It's very small in size, easy to transport. What it consists of is essentially a reel that you can just wind up real quick with a protective housing around it, so your antenna is protected when it's wound up. Got a clip to attach that to something, and that since that is isolated from the antenna, it can be a conductive surface. It does not matter. The antenna extends to a full 23 feet. When it's not in use, you can just wind it up. It'll fit in a pocket. The antenna is terminated with an 1/8-inch mini plug. It plugs directly into the external antenna jack of most shortwave radios. If your receiver doesn't have an external antenna jack, 1/8-inch size, it comes with an antenna clip. What this does, it's a quick adapter. It all comes with the kit. The 1/8-inch plug plugs into it. And it has a conductive clip on the other end that's insulated on the outside. So in case you touch it or grab it or it rubs against something, you're not going to lose signal. That attaches to the telescopic antenna on your radio. That allows you to use this with a radio without an external plug. It's a nice feature of this kit. It's a Sangene ANT60. The price for that is $13.95 plus postage. Another radio I've had some questions about. Seems like I always get the questions about this radio right prior to the show. I don't know why that is. It doesn't bother me. It just seems very strange. Three nights in a row, right before the show was going to go on the air, someone called and asked about this radio. So I want to cover it real quick. ATS-818-ACS. That's the 818-ACS. It's a really good radio. Very popular with many people that work shift work and whatnot, or have schedules that just don't match the times of their favorite shows. The reason is because it has a programmable cassette deck built in. That's a very popular feature with a lot of people. Okay, the ATS-818-ACS is a full-featured radio. Has the synthesized tuning. Covers all shortwave bands with continuous coverage also between, but all shortwave bands from 120 meter down to 11 meter. It's got a radio type clock, alarm clock. Can be used for two functions. Can be either used as a conventional alarm clock, or can be used when set for a show where you don't have to just watch the clock if you're running around the house and whatnot. You can type it in 5 minutes prior to your favorite show coming on. Boom, it kicks on. It's got BFO for single sideband and CW. 45 memory presets. It's got AM wide and narrow filters. It's a nice feature right there. The AM wide and narrow will give the effect of changing the tone, but what it also does is often clears up the reception of a station. It's got dual time display for local and UTC. RF gain control, that's very handy for knocking out competing signals that are either very close in the spectrum or just even a little farther away, but very powerful closer signals. Really helps tune in more distant signals. Signal strength and battery indicators, tone control, the lock function. It's got 5 different tuning methods. That comes in really handy depending on what you're wanting to do. You've either got direct frequency input, if you know exactly where you want to go, again, keypad entry. Auto scan, manual scan. Manual scan is just simply up and down arrows. It's got memory recall and a conventional rotary dial on the side of it. You still get the readout, just like all the other methods on this LCD screen, but you use a knob. Many people like to tune that way. A lot of it's the feel. When they hit a good strong signal, they feel it's easier to stop than the buttons. Stop moving at least. It's a really nice radio. The cassette deck, very high quality, fully programmable. You can program it for the time that you want it to begin recording, and it will do so. It shuts off automatically at the end of the tape. That's a feature that's very, very popular with a lot of people. This helps you if you have a broadcast, like I said earlier, that isn't convenient for you, your schedule, you can record it and listen to it later. Okay? One other thing about it, also, you have a backup. Now, and there might be just those little incidents when you can't be around and whatnot. The ATS 818 ACS, shortwave, FM, medium wave, long wave, single sideband with cassette, is $249.95 plus $6 postage. Alrighty? I think that's all I'm going to cover this evening. We really appreciate everybody out there. Hope you enjoyed the broadcast. Tune in next week, 9 p.m. Eastern, on 7.415 megahertz WBCQ for the hour of the time. Thank you.
the mission. For you have entered the corporate television. So everybody just make that dash. Attach to the Crypt Keeper's monster badge. To come along with the Keeper's plan. But this is the Crypt Jam.
You've been listening to the Hour of the Time. Join us next Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, for more exciting broadcasts. You're listening to 101.1 FM Eager.
Never will, like God loves you. Oh, yeah.